This is the Mideast Madness Show. I am Ren Tawil. I've been doing the show now since last July, so May, June, July. We're closing in more or less on my first anniversary. What's my motivation? Where am I coming from? If this is your first time listening, you may have heard from a friend or enemy that this show appears on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and you were drawn to it. Okay, let's make a few things clear. Free Radio is indeed a standing, ongoing civil disobedience action, an act of civil disobedience, in that we do not wish what we have to say to be restricted by the FCC or any other division of the federal government or the law. Free Radio has been around since 1995. In fact, we just celebrated our 18th birthday recently, a couple, week or two ago. Motivation for the Mideast Madness Show. My father was born and raised in Jerusalem. He was a Palestinian Christian. He is no longer with us. And he happened to be in the United States when the modern state of Israel was declared into existence on May 14th, 1948. He could very easily have been killed, as was his brother, as was his cousin, both by Zionist partisan militants. But instead, being here, he simply was not permitted to return home, which was his intention all along. He was here in the U.S. on business, family business and business, but the new Israeli government disvalidated his passport and did not recognize any property or right of him to return home. This was true for some 60,000 Palestinians, approximately, who happened to be outside of Palestine when things happened. They were not permitted to return. And, of course, the 750,000 Palestinian refugees, who for a variety of reasons, mostly fear and panic, left their homes and property behind before the Great War, as it were, of May 15th, many of them remain refugees today, and their descendants and their descendants' descendants live in refugee camps. All of them, regardless of where they are or what their economic or environmental status is, they're all refugees. By some measure or another, I might be considered a refugee by some measure or another of the law, that is. But that's not exactly where I'm coming from. I do care about my Palestinian heritage, but that's not certainly not my main priority, being recognized as a refugee. Instead, there are many, many things bouncing around about the truth regarding conflict between Israelis and Arabs, between Jews and Muslims and Christians. So, I spend roughly the next 2 hours talking about things from my perspective. Ergo, it is slanted. My sentiment is definitely with the Palestinian cause and to a large degree to the Arab cause in general. I can't pretend to be objective, but I promise to be civil as best as I know how. If anyone cares to call in to Mideast Madness today, I will treat you with respect to the best of my ability. Regardless of how you may treat me, I will give you the phone numbers now to the studio. Area code 831-427-3772. 427-3772. We also have a line number 2, if you prefer that. 4693119. Again, line 2 is 4693119. You may call at any point. Don't be shy. Don't worry about interrupting me. Oh, and by the way, I expect to end this show, roughly the last 10 minutes of it. We do go until 4:55, 5 minutes before 5 Pacific Daylight Time here on the west coast of North America. My buddy Jeff Halper, he happens to be a Minnesota Jew. He was born and raised, first 15 years of his life anyway, up on the range, the Minnesota Iron Range. He is a Jew, and having dinner with him last night, he specified that, and this is his words now, Dr. Halper's words, he and his family were the only Minnesota Jews who were not related to Bob Dylan. I'm not sure what he means by that, but all you Ancestry.com followers and genealogists of various stripes can look that up for yourselves. Dr. Jeff Halper, PhD, is a Jew and is an Israeli. I suspect he has a dual citizenship between Israel and the United States. He resides in Jerusalem, but he's currently touring the U.S. and giving his talks. Dr. Halper is co-founder and current executive director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And of course, this refers to the demolitions of Palestinian homes, which are almost entirely an illegal operation, at least as seen by the world community. Dr. Halper spoke last night at the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz here. And it was a wonderful talk. I won't speak too much about it. I certainly won't try to give verbatim his talk in the course of this show, but I do expect to be talking with him for some 10 minutes, starting at around 4:45 Pacific time. I have in my hot little hands a booklet which my nephew came across roughly a month ago. He was over the hill in Campbell, a suburb of San Jose, pulled into a service station to fill up, and he found stacks and stacks, as he put it, of these booklets on top of each gas pump. Just sitting there, obviously for the taking. He took one, and he gave it to me. Thank you, Jeffrey. That's my nephew, Jeffrey, not Dr. Halper. Israeli-Arab Conflict, A Primer to Understanding the Centuries-Old Struggle. And on the very bottom of the front cover, it says, and in big, bold, white letters, anti-Semitism is the dissemination of falsehoods about Jews in Israel. Now, just hearing that much from me about that booklet, Many of you will recognize or strongly suspect that this is full of propaganda, pro-Israeli propaganda, pro-Zionism propaganda. Okay. Let's get to the meat of this. I want to address this booklet, since there are so many of them floating around, some free for the taking. And there are a lot of these kinds of things floating around. They're certainly on the internet. This is a softback booklet, as it were. Not a paperback book, but it's, let's see, we got, it is some 40 pages long. Israeli-Arab Conflict, Primer to Understanding the Centuries-Old Struggle. I was motivated to respond to this. There is, on the front cover, a background of an ancient wall, ancient stucco or cement, whatever, full of bullet holes. Picture of bullet holes on a wall with the Israeli flag on top, and underneath that, not exclusively the flag of Palestine, but the green flags of Hamas, who Israel deems to be nothing more than Jew haters. We'll deal with that later. But there is a big red portion of the background picture of the bullet holes, where it says Israeli-Arab conflict, big and red. Primer to understanding the centuries-old struggle. Let me address that sentence right away, that phrase. Understanding the centuries-old struggle. I think they may have been careful to use the word struggle and not conflict, because one hears off and on that those Arabs and Jews have been fighting for centuries. They've been fighting for 2,000 years. No, they have not been in a continuous state of war. There have indeed been conflicts between them, relatively short periods over the course of the last roughly 20 to 2,500 years. There have also been a number of notable instances of cooperation between Jews and Arabs, even between Jews and Muslims. A very recent example, probably not a major one, but an important recent example was, by and large, when the first the first Jewish settlers to Palestine in the mid-1800s, the 19th century, began to come over and settle in Palestine, prodded on by the Zionist dream of establishing a national home for the Jews. That's what Zionism is. That for the most part, they got along with their Arab neighbors. And in most instances, they continued to get along with their Arab neighbors until about November of 1947, when the United Nations took action to divide Palestine between the native Palestinian Arabs and the mostly relatively new coming Jews. An Arab state area and a Jewish state area. That was not reacted too well by the native Arab population, who really had almost no hand. They did not have a hand in this partition plan. They were asked once or twice by the UN if they had anything to say. And this is one of the big mistakes of the Arab world, of the Palestinians, who mostly leaderless since the Arab revolt of 36 to 39 against Great Britain, saw the exile of their political leaders. The political structure of the Palestinians in 1947-48 was in shambles. Not much to begin with, as they were consistently sabotaged by Britain and the new coming Zionist Jews. But getting back to the example I wanted to give you there of cooperation between Muslims and Jews, under the British authority between 1920 and 1948, there had developed a union of workers. I forget which field of employment that was, but they were unionized, and there were both Arabs and Jews, Muslims and Jews, and Christians, and others, who had been developing this union partnership in developing the economy, co-developing the economies of Palestine. And that was torn asunder and turned into a shambles in the civil war which preceded the pronouncement of the State of Israel. And the ever-lauded invasion by some neighboring Arab states. So there are historic instances of cooperation and peace, usually peace, between Jews and Arabs. But, alas, the subtitle of this book, Primer to Understanding the Centuries-Old Struggle, is, the wording is perhaps meant to take attention away from the continuous war suggestion, and instead refer to the struggle of the Jews, who were tossed around quite a bit by the Romans and the Babylonians. They fought with the ancient Philistines who preceded them in the land of Canaan, which is an earlier word for Palestine. Maybe you caught on to the similarity between the word Philistine and Palestine, the latter being based on the earlier land of the Philistines. I have read that the word Philistine translates roughly as people of the sea, as the land of Canaan lies on the eastern Mediterranean shore. But again, we, in the Judaic Christian philosophy that we were brought up in, we were taught, even us Lutherans, I was a Lutheran when I was a kid, my father being a Christian Palestinian, I grew up in the Lutheran Church, Protestants in general, the Catholics, have heard about how Canaan was intended, was called by God the land of milk and honey, or his people, the Hebrew people, according to the Old Testament, referred to it as land of milk and honey, which, according to their scripture, the Jewish scripture, was deemed them by God. It was theirs to take. This same Judaic Christian philosophy of the West rarely, if ever, told you that there was a people already there, east of the Sinai, and up as far north as the Levant, roughly the southern border of Lebanon with northern Palestine, northern Israel. And they fought, which is to say, when the Israelis entered their promised land of milk and honey, the indigenous peoples there, the Philistines, and whatever else they may have called themselves, didn't exactly politely say, okay, you can come in, we'll clear out. Nobody did that in those days, and for many centuries afterwards, almost a good 2 millennia after, this kind of thing never happened. Of course, people took to the sword. Empires have waxed and waned, and the ancient Hebrew Empire, as tiny as it was compared to the Romans, say, or the Muslim Empire, the Islamic Empire, in that case, the Israelis invaded And this is historically true. They committed their own atrocities. They slaughtered hundreds, or if not thousands, of people at a time as they were goaded by their promise from God. Okay, how did I get to talking about that now? I'm using the book itself as this booklet here, this primer, so-called primer, as a kind of overview of my talk. Instead of writing an overview paper, I'm just starting with the front cover and going through it. So the struggle, centuries-old struggle, in the subtitle, apparently refers to the struggle of the Jews, which is renowned for the Jewish people, the Jews as a people, being decimated off and on, moved about, some of them. The word exile is very important to the Jewish tradition. The big one, referring to their decision to leave the rule of the pharaohs in Egypt. As far as I know, this was not a decree by the pharaohs, you must leave, and therefore you are officially exiled. Indeed, as we've all seen in the movie The Ten Commandments, Pharaoh did not want his slave workers to leave. The Hebrews were slaves under the pharaoh, and so when they tried to walk out, he chased after them. So, this migration of the Jews eastward is referred to somewhat erroneously as an exile. There were also smaller exiles over the next few hundred years of the Jews, what they called exiles. One example is when the Babylonians, a few hundred years after their flight from Egypt, the Hebrews' flight from Egypt, when the Babylonians came in and conquered Israel and Canaan and other areas, they took a number of Jews with them, most likely as slaves. Not all of them, but many Jews were brought by the Babylonians out of their homes in Canaan. And perhaps some of them, at the end of Babylonian rule, returned to Canaan. Not all, but some. Again, they referred to this as an exile, since the Jews have such a strong connection to that concept. And again, it was a situation where they were taken out of their homes, it's true, out of their adopted homeland, but taken into Babylonia to serve as slaves again. Let's move on. The cover of this booklet also features a picture of none other than Martin Luther King Jr., the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Very handsome picture of him. And a quotation. When people criticize Zionists, they mean Jews. You're talking anti-Semitism. A supposed quotation from Dr. Martin Luther King. When people criticize Zionists, they mean Jews. You're talking anti-Semitism. They actually don't use quotations. They simply put the two sentences next to a picture of the good Dr. King. Let's take a close look at this. Apparently, Dr. King, early in his civil rights and peace-promoting career, particularly since he was a reverend, as a man of the church, man of the book, he identified to some degree with the Jews. And early in his career came to be sympathetic to the Jews. The Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, the acronym CAMERA, or perhaps CAMERA, is actually They call themselves a committee for accuracy in Middle East reporting, but they are normally staunchly pro-Israel, anti-Palestinian group. So one has to be cautious when they see the term committee for accuracy in their name. This is from Chimera. Now, you heard me say that they're anti-Palestinian, pro-Israel, pro-Zionist, which makes this communication here all the more remarkable. Chimera, January 22nd of 2002, this is 11 years ago, entitled Chimera Alert, Letter by Martin Luther King, a Hoax. The flowery pro-Zionist, quote, letter to an anti-Zionist friend, allegedly written by, allegedly written by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., is apparently a hoax. However, the basic message of the letter was indeed, without question, spoken by Martin Luther King Jr. at a dinner in Cambridge, Massachusetts, shortly before he was assassinated. At that dinner, he rebuked a student who made an anti-Zionist remark, saying, this is Dr. King talking, when people criticize Zionists, they mean Jews. You are talking anti-Semitism. See, for example, The Socialism of Fools, The Left, The Jews and Israel by Seymour Martin Lipset, Encounter Magazine, December 1969. This primer that I'm talking about, using my program to talk about here, uses what they can, what is reportedly two sentences that were spoke by Dr. King at a dinner in 1968. However, there is another letter that's really at the center of this Chimera dispatch. It goes on, we were initially doubtful of the authenticity of the letter to an anti-Jewish friend because the language in the first paragraph seemed almost a parody of language used in Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. Additionally, we could find no reference to the, quote, letter prior to 1999, which was odd because the text is such a dramatic denunciation of anti-Zionism. One that would have been cited widely. Again, I am reading from a January 2002 dispatch from the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, a strongly biased group contradicting the name of the group, Committee for Accuracy, biased towards Israel. Continuing. However, we then found the, quote, letter in a reputable 1999 book, Shared Dreams by Rabbi Mark Schneer, whose preface was written by Martin Luther King III. Since the King family is known to be extremely careful with Dr. King's legacy, we assumed they must have verified the accuracy of the book before endorsing it. Additionally, we found that quotations from the letter were used on July 31st, 2001 by the Anti-Defamation League's Michael Salberg. The Anti-Defamation League, I will clarify, is a Zionist advocacy group which stands constantly and consistently against anti-Semitism, or the hatred of the Jews. Anti-Defamation League does not like hatred of the Jews. They don't like anti-Semitism. Additionally, we found the quotations from the letter were used on July 31st, 2001 by the Anti-Defamation League's Michael Salberg in testimony before the United States House of Representatives International Relations Committee's Subcommittee on International Operations and Human Rights. The same, quote, source, Saturday Review, August 67, for the letter that was mentioned in the Schneer book was also cited in the testimony. Since many in the Anti-Defamation League had actually worked with Martin Luther King Jr. in the civil rights struggle, we assumed, again, they would be very knowledgeable about King's work and would have thoroughly checked anything they chose to read before Congress. However, because we do not ordinarily rely on anyone else's research, we decided to double-check. By searching back issues of Saturday Review, Rabbi Schneer's book had referenced the letter as being published in the August 67 Saturday Review. We found no such letter in any of the August issues, nor do the page and volume numbers cited conform to those actually used by that publication. Camara, the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, also checked with Boston University, where Dr. King's work is archived. The archivists, too, were unable to locate any such letter. We can only conclude that no such letter was written by Dr. King. And please note, we are not implying that the apparently bogus, quote, letter, end quote, originated with Rabbi Schneer. They're not saying Rabbi Schneer is responsible for it. Let us continue. Since the message of the letter, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, was one Martin Luther King Jr. had indeed articulated, we can understand why the King family and the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, did not feel the need to verify the letter to an anti-Zionist friend. This episode is a reminder of the importance of verifying the authenticity and accuracy of sources, even when they appear to be solid. I'm going to read that whole paragraph again because it's important. Since the message of the letter, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, was one Martin Luther King Jr. had indeed articulated, we can understand why the King family and the ADL did not feel the need to verify the, quote, letter to an anti-Zionist friend. This episode is a reminder of the importance of verifying the authenticity and accuracy of sources, even when they appear to be solid. And then this Camara dispatch has a copy of the January 21, 2002 opinion editorial op-ed by U.S. Representative John Lewis, who worked closely with Dr. King. In the op-ed, he shares Dr. King's views on Israel, views which stressed Israel's democratic nature and Israel's need for security. He also relates that Dr. King said, when people criticize Zionists, they mean Jews. You are talking anti-Semitism. I'm not going to read you the hoax letter. Suffice it to say, it's been established as a hoax. All right. So, the people who published this primer to understanding the centuries-old struggle of the Israeli-Arab conflict are using a quotation which most likely was said by Dr. King. But they were careful, just as obviously, to avoid any of the articulations in the bogus, false letter, supposed letter that Dr. King supposedly wrote to his anti-Zionist friend. So they have a quotation by him, but they won't tell, this book says nothing about any of the other details that originated in the bogus letter. Personally, I feel that Dr. King, as I said a few minutes ago, as a Christian reverend in the Christian church, was sympathetic to Jews, and the way he saw things then, automatically sympathetic towards Israel. I believe he was subjected to much of the same propaganda that other Americans have been subjected to. and indeed was compromised on that subject. Then again, the bulk of his efforts have been directed towards the civil rights of African Americans in his own country, the United States, particularly in the Dixie South. Before I open the book, I'll read that sentence again on the very bottom of it. Anti-Semitism is the dissemination of falsehoods about Jews and Israel. Their table of contents reads, Part 1, History, Part 2, Jerusalem, Part 3, Anti-Semitism, the topic of anti-Semitism, and Part 4, The Muslim World. This is how they line up the story. Introductory page here. Claims, I'm not going to read the whole thing to you verbatim, but I'll point out many flaws. Today, Israel is surrounded by oppressive Arab states ruled under Islamic Muslim Sharia law. Not all of them. In fact, a minority of the 22 Arab countries who are represented in the Arab League, kind of umbrella organization like the UN or NATO or CENTO, one of those, most of the Arab countries have their federal law, at least as it is written, bears more towards the secular rather than religious tradition or sectarian tradition. All the Arab states are populated by a majority of Muslims, those of the Islamic faith. But Sharia law, I believe there are a number of phrases in this book which those who are pro-Israel love to repeat and repeat and repeat when they're talking about the Israeli-Arab conflict, to the point sometimes of trying to frighten Western peoples, people in the United States, Jews and non-Jews, into revulsion of Sharia law and claiming that all the Muslims want to take over the United States and substitute our constitutional government with Sharia law. So they're playing that card there. It says here, Israel is governed differently. It follows modern principles that separate church and state. Israel does not have a constitution, a written constitution, but it does have their own Declaration of Independence, in which it is said, roughly, that Jews and all non-Jews in the state of Israel shall be treated with equal rights and equal political rights. It says so in the Declaration of Independence. And then they turn around and they create the modern state of Israel, and then they proceed to create a state which is utterly oriented toward Judaism. Reestablishment of the Jewish homeland, as it were, Zionism, in Palestine, and doing nothing for the native Arabs who consider themselves Palestinians. The Israelis don't even use the word Palestinian. It's a dirty word to them. They see it as not at all valid based on their rendition of history. I disagree. Many people disagree there. Is a sense of being Palestinian. My father, one of the earliest words that I recall proceeding from my father's mouth was the word Palestine when he told friends and associates where he was from. He would say Jerusalem, which is true, where he grew up and was born. And then immediately after, he would say the word Palestine with great pride. And many times I have heard him say this. This is well before 1967 or 65, when supposedly all the native Arabs immediately decided, hey, we're Palestinians after all. No. There was a national movement of towards a Palestinian nationhood. Dr. Jeff Halper, who we'll be speaking with in about an hour, I hope, says that this national movement in its contemporary sense began about 100 years ago, and he is a Jew. Mr. Halper is a Jew. There were suggestions. I understand that in the 1800s there was the suggestion of a unified state between present-day Palestine, including what is called Israel, and Jordan, present-day Jordan, and that should be Palestine. So there was indeed talk of Palestine for, according to Dr. Halper, for roughly 100 years ago, that began. It didn't just crop up all of a sudden like a disease. So Israel, claiming to be a democracy, has a very this terrible dichotomy of endeavoring, both by philosophy and by law, of being a Jewish state, wanting to be referred to as the Jewish state of Israel, even though 70% of its population are Jews. The remaining 30% are not Jews. They are Arabs, either Muslim or Christian or Druze, that's Druze, Muslim sect, Zoroastrian or other faiths, or no faith at all. They, the Arabs are allowed the vote. But I don't think that's because the powers that be of Israel, in the Knesset, in the Prime Minister's office, and the President, I don't think it's because they crave the opinion of the non-Jewish Arabs, who they call Israeli citizens. Israel could not be called a democracy if they denied the vote to Arabs. They've known this all along. They have seen, I'm sure they anticipated that Israel would be a democratic republic all along, but in order to preserve that facade, that veneer, a kind of a mask of democracy, they had to give the Arabs the vote. And they're constantly, American Jews are constantly pointing to that. Israel's a democratic state. Israel's a democratic state. All right, I know that the Arab countries, for the most part, are not democratic states. That doesn't give anyone, including Israel, the right to fallaciously refer to themselves as a democracy. Israel, in reality, is an ethnocracy. And ethnocracy, which puts all the focus on repopulating, and they're still doing this. They have consistently made efforts and pronounced to the world that they want to repopulate Palestine, all of Palestine preferably, by their measure, with Jews and only Jews. I really don't know what they expect is going to happen to the 30-odd percent who are living there as non-Jews. Do they expect them to be converted to Judaism? Do they expect them to leave? Are they being driven out? Will there be another Final Solution-style massacre? Also, there are a number of many, many contradictions to this broad statement in their Declaration of Independence, Israel's Declaration of Independence, that Jew and non-Jew shall live with parity and equality and equal rights. There are a number of laws having to do with intermarriage, where you can live if you are intermarried. There is a kind of eminent domain, as we would call it here in the U.S., when the government declares that they have the right to relieve certain Arab citizens of their property for security reasons or for some state project. Israel has an awful, terrible history of absconding with sources of water for Arabs, for Arab homes, not only in the occupied territories, but inside Israel itself. Of course, the occupied territories is another terrible, terrible story. 100 times worse for those Arabs in terms of the so-called democracy. There is no democracy under Israeli rule for Arabs in the West Bank, Judea, Samaria, whatever you want to call it. So that is that. Let's move on. Those who may have heard my show, last week's show, I went, took up most of the show to talk about, took up about half of last week's show to talk about the natural gas deposits, which lie off the coast of Israel and off the coast of the Gaza Strip, the Mediterranean Sea coast. They lie under the earth at the bottom of the sea. Some of these, at least one of them, a major oil field, lies in jurisdictional Gazan waters, which is to say Palestinian waters, as it's recognized around the world. The field, I forget the name of it, lying in Gazan waters, not in international waters, supposedly gives the Palestinians a right to exploit that natural resource and gain some wealth from that. But they have a paragraph in this opening page here of this notorious booklet. Until the recent discovery of large offshore natural gas deposits, Israel had few natural resources, including oil, but has an entrepreneurial spirit that has helped to it become a center of research and development. Okay, they briefly mention the fact that there are large offshore natural gas deposits, saying nothing about how they are in the process of stealing the Gazan field, in addition to exploiting the ones that are supposedly in Israeli waters. They may or may not lie in Israeli waters. They may lie in international waters. But I suspect they want to mention natural gas because there's a lot of hum about how natural gas is going to save us from dependency on the terrible Arab regime's oil deposits. So these evil foreign powers, as it were, cannot turn them off and bring the U.S. to a standstill, or bring the West to a standstill. So they wanted to slip in there the fact that they have access to natural gas deposits. They're not telling you the whole story. I gave the details in last week's show. They say all Israeli citizens have benefited from the country's success. I would say they have to varying degrees. In addition, the greater the economic success of the Jews in Israel, regardless of any spillover to Israel's Palestinian citizens, Palestinian Arabs, there are instances where the Palestinians still lose out. Jerusalem is an awful mess a city which supposedly has been redivided by Israel, never, quote-unquote, never to be divided again, actually has about a half dozen different designations of different parts of the cities and the suburbs having to do with religious nature of the populations in certain areas, things you can and cannot do, ways and play and directions that you can and cannot travel. Jerusalem is chopped up by a terrible bureaucracy and of these regional restrictions. I read the details of that a couple of months ago to you. If anyone wants me to go over any of this stuff again, you can either call me here in the studio at area code 831-427-3772. Line 2 is 831-469-3119. Don't hesitate to call me, regardless of what you have to say or how strongly you do or do not agree with me. I might, you know, anyone who might come across this program here on Free Radio Santa Cruz may dismiss me as just another propagandist and apologist for the Arabs. Indeed, if you think so, let's talk about it. You also have the option, by the way, of sending me an email. The show, Mideast Madness is the name of the show, and the show's email address is MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's MideastMadness, all one word, at G as in George, M as in make believe, X as in Xerxes.com. Send me an email. I promise I will not abuse the fact that you may be sending the email from your own authentic personal or business account. Okay. Says here in the purported primer of the Israeli-Arab conflict, support for Islamic countries has become a popular political attitude in some circles. The reasoning is often related to, as they put it here, the false belief that Israel stole, the word stole in quotes, Palestinian Arab lands and mistreated the Arab refugees. The people and the kind of people who write this so-called primer want to maintain one of the greatest hoaxes that have been perpetrated on the world at large, that Israel, to begin with, freely settled Palestine in the modern era, that Jews who turned to Zionism for a national homeland freely and legitimately settled in Palestine and then simply declared their state of Israel the very day after which the Arabs attacked them. This is, as I'm sure it sounds to most reasonable people, a monstrously simplistic version of what happened. The Ottoman Empire, what is called Turkey today, ruled Palestine and much of other Arab countries close to surrounding Palestine for about 400 years. The Ottoman Turks sided with Germany during the First World War. So when the Germans lost World War I, the Turks lost World War I, as did the Austro-Hungarians. And the Bulgarians, incidentally. Small countries that don't get a lot of talk, lip service, or attention long after the fact. After the Ottomans lost the First World War, Great Britain, conquered, as it were, or militarily conquered, Palestine and ran Palestine roughly from 1920, or the end of the war as it was approaching, 1917, 1918, until May of 1948. And it was under either Ottoman rule, which was an imperialistic rule of foreign soil, where the Turks were governing and abusing with an iron hand non-Turks, that the modern Israelis began their settlement of Palestine. They didn't exactly... They didn't need the permission of the native Palestinians. Instead, they took the official route of going through the imperialistic bosses. First the Ottoman Turks, and then Great Britain. And Great Britain not only permitted the sale, the often absentee landlord's sale of Palestinian land to the Jewish immigrants, they actually encouraged it to a great deal, as there were many British Jews who were Zionist, and they were influential both in the government and in the class sense in Great Britain. And they had a lot of pull in making the British complicit in establishing the Zionist dream, as it were. So, even though it was a tiny trickle of Jewish migration which began to repopulate Palestine, that, of course, increased and swole to a... would swell into a flood of migration after the terrible Holocaust of the Second World War. And this was happening so fast that, yes, indeed, a number of Palestinians were having a hard time with this economic usurpation of much of their resources. And even though, in some legal sense, that the land which changed property ownership from Arab to Jew might not have been stolen, it felt like the Palestinians felt like they were being stolen from, which led to the Arab Revolt of 1936 to 1939, after 3 years was crushed by Great Britain, and the Palestinian national leaders were either killed or exiled, leaving, as I said earlier, the Palestinian national struggle in a shambles, virtually leaderless. And indeed, by the time of the UN pronounced partition plan between Arab and Jew of Palestine, where the Jews were to receive 56% of the land and the Arabs 44% of the land, the Zionist Jews getting the most fertile, preferred, wet areas, the most pro-agricultural areas, and most of the seacoast. When that UN thing happened, I'm just looking for the sentence again that I was referring to. When that partition was pronounced on November 29th of 1947, that's when the actual theft of Arab land in Palestine began. Theft by any measure, which is to say, the Zionist militias that had been building up for some 3 years, this is documented historical fact, under a number of phases of anticipated military strategy for roughly between 45 and the end of 1947, there were some half dozen or so, at least, Jewish militant partisans who were being supplied with arms under the table. There wasn't Great Britain, under their rule, officially forbade the import of weapons, small arms, and large arms for that matter, by anyone but themselves, the British, into Palestine. But clandestinely, the Zionist partisans were importing guns, some from the Eastern Europe, behind the Iron Curtain, where they could get a hold of them, brand new submachine guns and other state-of-the-art equipment for the individual soldier. They also had artillery pieces, some mechanized vehicles, land vehicles, and they even had a small air force. They had access to some airplanes, which developed into the Israeli Air Force later on. And they committed some 70 massacres, all documented, all historical fact, including, yes, Deir Yassin. I have no hesitancy to remind people of Deir Yassin. The, let me see, 56, 70, 80, 90, 70th anniversary of which was celebrated just this month, April 9th, where somewhere between 130 and over 200 unarmed, mostly unarmed Palestinian civilians were slaughtered by these Zionist partisans. And, of course, they took control of that village. The Zionists took control of that village. They took control of the farmhouse and the land which belonged to my father's cousin, whom the Israelis killed with their rifle butts in the West Bank. A small personal horror story, which was repeated countless times by the Israeli invaders, who proceeded then to militarily sanitize as much of Palestine as they could of the Arabs, followed by the totally illegitimate takeover of the of those dead or fleeing Palestinian lands. So this primer refers to the false belief, what it calls the false belief that Israel, quote-unquote, stole Palestinian lands. They want you to believe that. But anyone who really takes the time to do some good old-fashioned research, and not just on the internet either, go to the library, find some old books. And this is literature which has been largely forgotten. And that void was filled in by the modern Israeli propaganda, the effort of the Israelis to convince the world that they, the Israelis, are the victims and are indeed the good guys who are oppressed. Referring to the support for Islamic countries becoming a popular political attitude in some circles, I think a major reason for that is because people are finding the truth, and perhaps the pendulum is shifting somewhat from support of Israel to support of the things that the Muslim Arab countries say. And that includes many American Jews, by the way. There are thousands and thousands of American Jews who are members of several dozen non-Zionist or even anti-Zionist organizations, because they see Zionism as it's being perpetrated by modern Israel and the current Israeli government, the current right-wing Israeli Likud government. They see it as detrimental to Judaism, as a contradiction to the things that Judaism stands for, and that so many Jews historically have fought for and stood by. Call me at the station here. It's 10 minutes after 4 Pacific Daylight Time in Santa Cruz County, California. Phone number is 831-427-3772. Alternatively, you may call me at 469-3119. This is the Mideast Madness Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming at freakradio.org. That's F-R-E-A-K radio.org. Go to the main page, scroll down to the image of the radio tower. There's a cute little red oval atop the tower. You click on that to engage your device to our streaming signal. Yeah, that sentence, false belief, so-called false belief that Israel stole Palestinian lands and mistreated the Arab refugees. They certainly mistreated them before they became refugees. They murdered hundreds of Palestinian citizens, unarmed men, old men, women, and children in 1948. They certainly murdered a number of them for show, which is an old trick that even the British used against the Arabs in Palestine. You kill a few in front of witnesses of their families and neighbors, and then you tell the rest of them to get the hell out of there. And naturally, if you see someone, if you see a bloodbath like that 10 feet in front of you, you're not going to stick around much longer. This was the main reason for the terrible flow of 750,000 Palestinian refugees. As they saw what happened, they were frightened out of their wits, and they were chased out. And that was the planned strategy of the Zionists. I have seen the writing. I have seen the documentation in Israel's and the Israeli military's own archives that attest to the fact that this outing of the Palestinian citizens was indeed part of a plan, a multi-staged plan. And the refugees were created because of abuses that the Israelis mistreated upon the Arabs. And then once the Arabs were refugees, they were physically apart from the Israelis. So in that sense, you cannot say that refugees were abused by Israel. They are abused by the broad fact that the Israelis will not permit them to return to their homes and reclaim their property. Instead, the Israelis took those homes. They also bulldozed somewhere between 500 and 900 villages, entire villages and towns, to make way for the newly established State of Zion. This, almost done with this first page of this thing here, the primer. It says, Israel is productive, successful, and our political and military partner. This, of course, is written in English and is directed towards Americans to, quote unquote, educate them about the truth, as it were, of the conflict in the Middle East. Israel is productive, successful, and our political and military partner. A main reason for Israel's high productivity and successful economy is the fact that it is tied so closely to the West. Not because Israel is an original Middle Eastern country, renegade Middle Eastern country, which turned to the United States and Canada and Europe, but it's kind of the other way around. Jews, largely from Europe and the United States and other places in the world, filed into Palestine, pronounced their state, and then continued with their democratic traditions, which is all fine and well. It sounds all fine and well that they chose to make Israeli government a government of choice. So they said early on it would be a democratic state, and they continued to call it a democratic state, despite all of the contradictions which exist to this day. And you got a successful Israeli economy, which is maintained by strong ties to the West, unhindered by a poorly developed Middle Eastern society and all the other Arab countries, which for a millennia or two found little use for those in the Western world. And although there were some contacts through trade and exploration, unfortunately, the Arabs, I don't say this with pride, this is history now. For millennia, for many centuries, Arabs mostly had nothing to do with the West due to philosophical and perhaps religious differences until the discovery of oil, until the fact that Western technologists found out how to use oil as an energy source and a basis for economic power. It was discovered in great abundance in the Middle East, and that slowly, or in spurts, in some rapid spurts, came to established this the new ties to the West. But in the case of Israel, there were already people who were well-to-do, Jews who lived in the Western world. I'm not saying that all the Israelis were filthy rich, but there were certainly some leaders, economic leaders, who had well-established ties with corporations and other sources of grand income in the Western world. And as far as being our, which is to say America's political and military partner, military partner against whom? Oh, of course, obviously, largely against a hostile Muslim part of the world whose fiercest Islamist radicals want to see domination of the world through Islam. You know, those, of course, are the worst examples. But the thing is, if it weren't for the terrible problems that the establishment of Israel brought to that region and against Palestinian Arabs and even against Jews who tried to settle in Israel, many of whom, of their own choice, have since left and became disenfranchised by the so-called Zionist dream. If it weren't for these problems that were perpetrated upon Palestine, historic Palestine, by trying to reclaim it as the land of Israel, there'd be no need for such a strong alliance between the U.S. and Israel. I mean, military partner, yes, but we wouldn't be having all these troubles. We wouldn't be having the terrible war in Afghanistan and the terrible war that we had in Iraq if it weren't for, at least in the case of one of those wars, Afghanistan, if we didn't have the 9/11 attacks. And there's still a lot of talk about who was really responsible for those attacks. 9/11 certainly galvanized American hatred against Muslims, which fell right into the laps of the Israelis. That was fine with the Israelis because they needed that boost, that sort of new Pearl Harbor event to galvanize more U.S. support, unchangeable U.S. support for Israel. It is by this awful design that Israel has developed into a military partner with the United States because of enemies that they themselves made. And that's the contradiction of boasting Israel as a military partner of the U.S. It says at the very bottom, Zionism is the national liberation movement of the Jewish people. That is an interpretation. Zionism is, by its original definition, according to Theodor Herzl, its father, the reestablishment of a national Jewish homeland, specifically Jewish national homeland, in the form of a modern state, which popularly and eventually became Palestine, the area of Palestine. As far as Zionism being a national liberation movement of the Jewish people, how could they possibly talking about, how could they be talking about the tiny number of Palestinian Jews who had lived generationally in Palestine since ancient times, when they weren't necessarily oppressed? Jews did maintain their own traditions, and maybe there was some resentment of that by Arab Muslims and others, but they still, again, for the most part, got along and lived at peace, more or less in peace, in Palestine, whether it was the Turks who controlled it, or the Mamluks, or Great Britain, or any other ancient power you want to talk about. Sometimes the Jews and the Arabs had to stand together to defend themselves against invaders and the iron hand of ancient military powers. And if by national liberation movement you're talking about freeing the Jewish people around the world, such as those who were entrapped by the Nazis, and many of them murdered, some 6 million of them murdered by the German Nazi Party, by Hitler, Germany lost that war. Germany lost the war, and the Jews who survived could have remained in Germany. Where else would they have to go if it were not for Zionism? They could have remained in Europe. They could. They were pogromed from Russia. It's true. But the application of the word liberation is not primarily good for talking about people who have been forced away from their home of many centuries. It's meant to talk about protecting the rights of Jews wherever they live in the world. This is the primary focus of liberation in modern liberation movements. To say Zionism is the national liberation movement of the Jewish people, it sounds good to us Americans, but liberation movement of the Jewish people, that phrase is a disguise and a substitution for what it really is, which is recolonization of land that they happen to have some ancestry in, displacing the native population of Arab Palestinians, in the case of the Golan Heights Syrians, and thousands of Lebanese who were killed or forced out in southern Lebanon with all the BS that was happening in there in 1982 and since then, and the establishment of the Jewish ethnocracy of Israel. Not a true democracy, but an ethnocracy which is focused around the religion, around the Judaic faith, and the needs and wants of exclusively Jewish people. That is the purpose of Israel. They essentially put up with the Arabs who did not flee or would not flee because they didn't want to create a bloodbath so soon after the pronouncement of their state, which would have brought the world down on them wholesale. Talk about United Nations sanctions and censorships against Israel. Countless of those that Israel utterly avoids, and they pull their puppet strings in Washington, and the Americans veto the American sitting on the UN Security Council vetoed these censures time and time again, because it only takes one of the five major powers sitting on the Security Council. It takes one veto to erase the whole matter. And Israel continues with impunity. They continue their mistreatment of Arabs and the practices of their so-called democracy. Well, you can, just as I said an hour and a half ago when I started this show, I have a sentiment toward the Palestinians. No kidding. Unless some people start to call me on the phone or send messages to the email address MideastMadness@gmx.com, old Larry here is going to be running off at the mouth. And I do that in the course of any given show. And I really want to keep that, I want to keep that dark tenor of my dissertations in check. I don't want to go crazy and demonizing Israel. It's just that I am, in this particular show, I am in the process of addressing this premiere, which is terrible propaganda in itself. And I simply have answers for a number of things that it states. I'm flipping the page now. We're getting to part one, the history. We have a map of ancient Israel, as the writers of this thing here claim Israel looked like between 1000 BC and 925 BC. Remember, if you're talking about before Christ or before the Common Era, another way of saying before Christ, or the politically correct way of saying before Christ, BCE, before the Common Era, you count backwards because you are counting down the years until Jesus' birth and eventual death and ascension, as the Christians believe. So from 1000 BCE to 925 BCE, a 70 to 75 year period of time during which is the ancient Israelites controlled all or part of present-day Israel, present-day West Bank and Gaza, a very small portion of the corner of Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, and then up to the area of Assyria, which is present-day northern Syria, ancient Assyria, including Damascus, including the western portion of modern Jordan. And even that was indeed a tiny empire. I don't mean to equate size with legitimacy here, but and only for a 70 to 75 period of any measure of stability, which is to say during the life and reign of King David. King David was essentially ancient Israel when it came to marking the place in history of the ancient Israelites. That was the height of their little empire, of their homeland. And, of course, there were the many, many other native peoples who they fought with. And they talk about the Babylonian exile. I already mentioned that so-called exile was the abduction of Jews, or the encouragement through whatever means of Jews to leave Israel and go into the Babylonian Empire to serve as second-class citizens, if not slaves. Yes, indeedy. And most of them were able to come back anyway. the thing about this primer is that it does give a lot of details in concise brackets of years about things that happened. The problem I have is that given the awful things they say about Muslims in particular and Muhammad, I can't trust the authenticity or the truthfulness of any of the other time periods that they're talking about. Yes, maybe everything they're saying is true. Well, no, everything they're saying is not true altogether. There are lies in this, but you know, they may be stating a lot of truths, they may be stating a lot of half-truths, but they make it sound really bad when it comes to the Jewish experience in the Middle East, and how they've suffered and how they've been scattered. What are the important facts about the history of the Jewish people in the Middle East is that far from being exiled, and only a portion of the Jews were exiled out of the land of Israel that they originally conquered from the Philistines. Far from being exiled, they, for mostly economic reasons, chose to leave Palestine and their Israeli promised land. They chose to give up the covenant that they claimed to have had with God, and they gave it up. They moved farther east into Persia, present-day Iran, into the Persian Empire, into the land of Babylonia again. They eventually went up to Europe and, of course, across the seas to the Americas. And the Jews set up strong, vibrant, local, if somewhat isolated, communities who maintained their Jewish traditions and exercised with various degrees of freedom their religious practices. Again, the way I see it is these Jews gave up the covenant that they had with God to people Israel, to repopulate Israel. Soon, I expect to be talking on the phone with my friend, Dr. Jeff Halper, PhD. Let me take one more look at what this book has to offer. Oh, boy. You see, there's a map here. A series of three maps. The first one shows present-day Israel, including West Bank and Gaza, and what is present-day Jordan, the Kingdom of Jordan, from 1917 to 1922, with, it says Palestine, and a little sentence underneath says, agreed to be the Jewish home under the British Mandate. Well, I've never come across anything that said all of Palestine and or all of what would instead become Jordan was to be the Jewish home. There was a promise made in the form of what's famously called the Balfour Declaration, which was issued in 1917 when World War I was still raging, to placate some Jewish Zionists. It was a statement from an official in the British government, London, Sir Arthur Balfour, which declared Britain's support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. I've never come across anything that said all of it was designated to be the new Jewish Israel, but that a home in Palestine, however it was viewed to be, would be the location of a Jewish homeland, not the Jewish homeland. Map number two here, dated 1923, has a separation of Palestine and... a picture of historic Palestine west of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea, which they label as remaining Jewish, 23% of Palestine. Of course, they're talking about the original designation. This is a European colonial British designation of this area and that area as being either Jordan or Palestine or Syria or Iraq or whatever you want to call it. It's what the Brits... It's based on the names that Great Britain gave these areas. Under the British mandate, Jews would have 23%, the westernmost part of Palestine slash Jordan. And then it says, in what is now Jordan, the label they put is given to Arabs. 77% of Palestine under the British mandate. Well, the Arabs were there to begin with. The Jews still made up less than 5% of the total population in what eventually became a separate British mandate of Palestine. Less than 1 out of 20 people were Jewish. But here, as they put it, east of the Jordan River would be, quote, given to Arabs. But the Arabs were already there. And most likely very, very few, an even smaller portion of Jews lived east of the Jordan River and east of the Dead Sea. I'm familiar with this as an argument, a kind of revisionist argument, which has been made in recent years. This land is my land crowd. They're trying to claim that by this ruling by a European colonial power, namely Great Britain, they are supposed to have, they claim the legitimacy of what they want to be Jewish homeland on that colonial ruling and a single short one-page statement, the Balfour Declaration, and I'm not familiar with any other legal or formal written justifications. And this is a terrible book that I'm referring to. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Okay, it's 4:39 Pacific Daylight Time. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. Let's have some more Egyptian music here. While I set things up for the next part of the program. Thank you. Hello, Dr. Halper.
Hi.
You're on Mideast Madness on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Can you give a short introduction of who you are, sir?
I'm Jeff Halper, the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition. I live in Jerusalem. And, you know, our organization is an Israeli peace and human rights organization dedicated to ending the occupation. And we look at the issue of house demolitions, where Israel's demolished about 28,000 Palestinian homes as a vehicle for exposing how the occupation works and trying to end it.
And, Dr. Halper, you... Instead of continuing to refer to you as Dr. Halper, as I said earlier in the stage, you and I met some 5 years ago on the island of Cyprus as we prepared to sail into the port of Gaza City. In fact, you found out that I lived in Minnesota, which I did at the time. I would return to, in less than 6 months' time, I would return to my native California. But
I don't know why anybody would return from Minnesota to California, but okay.
Yeah, that seems to be the general direction of migration, east to west.
Right.
I've always felt bad because I felt that I was kind of rebuking your... connection to me as a Minnesotan, and I was focused on somebody else that I wanted to be partnered with, because if we were using the buddy system in this sailing trip into Gaza, and we agreed to be buddies, and I kind of feel like I wasn't paying much attention to you, and it was really stupid of me. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, this is a man who was literally nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, and I knew it at the time. I was so wrapped up into myself at that point in my personal history that I just...
That's right. Five years later, I forgive you.
Well, thanks. But you had all along, right? Okay. Thank you so much,
along.
Jeff. You've also written a few books.
That's right.
And you were... I guess you're still in this part of Central California here. You spoke at the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz last night.
That's right. Tonight I'm speaking at the Peace Resource Center in Monterey.
Can you give us the address?
No.
Okay, but it's...
It's actually in, what's it called? What's just before Monterey? Seaside or Oceanside?
There's this town, kind of a suburb of Monterey called Seaside.
That's where it is.
Then it's in the town of Seaside. The Peace Center of Monterey, is it?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Jeff, have you been listening to my show at all, by chance?
No, it doesn't get all the way to Jerusalem.
Well, I mean today's show. Have you listened to...
No, I haven't had a chance.
Okay.
I'm actually right now in the Monterey Aquarium.
Oh, I finally visited that place about a year ago. I read about
right.
it over 20 years ago when I was still when I was driving taxi in Minneapolis.
Yeah, and you need a little bit of a break from the occupation sometimes.
Absolutely. You want to take advantage of all of those. And you've been exposed to so many disturbing, frustrating disappointments in your efforts to get your message across, including the multiple demolitions of a single location.
That's right. We work with one Palestinian family whose home has been demolished 6 times by the Israeli authorities.
But always rebuilt. Except this last time, instead of rebuilding a whole new home, as it were, they're going to do what?
We're going to make it into a memorial. It's obvious that the Israelis are targeting it.
Mm-hmm.
So, we resist the Israeli occupation by rebuilding Palestinian homes. We built about 186 homes in the last 12, 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
As political acts of resistance. And so, this family's home that's targeted, that's been demolished and redemolished, we've stayed with the family, But because they're really targeting this family's house, we decided after six homes that we shouldn't really spend so much money doing that, and we're going to make it into a site, kind of memorializing, because we have the demolition intact, memorializing demolitions, displacement of Palestinians, but using it as a site for conferences, for tours to come, you know, in other words, to use it really as a living site of resistance to occupation, not simply as a ruin.
Okay. Jeff, you consider yourself to be an Israeli, is that correct?
That's right. I've been in Israel now for 40 years. I have Israeli citizenship. Yeah.
Do you have dual citizenship with the United States?
Yeah, I have dual citizenship, so...
Okay.
I can either vote for Romney or Netanyahu. I have my pick.
Or perhaps Netanyahu or Netanyahu. Yeah, I was in the early part of my show, a little after 3 o'clock. I was saying a few words about you and your talk in Santa Cruz last night, and I remember a number of things. Of course, I remember from your talk, but I'm concerned about something you said a couple of times, that the movement for national, for Palestinian nationhood, or a national Palestinian movement, goes back about 100 years. What is the event, or what were the circumstances about 100 years ago that you measure this from?
Well, there were a couple things. First of all, in the Middle East, you began to have the rise of modern nationalism following the rise of nationalism in Europe, and you began to have Egyptian nationalism, even Arab nationalism, Lebanese nationalism, Syrian, and also Palestinian. You know, the rise of national movements.
When you say
Arab,
but
at the same time, with Zionism coming to the country, with Jews coming to Palestine claiming that it's their country and their national rights, the Palestinian nationalism also grew in reaction to that, and that was all before World War One. Actually, and it got more and more momentum after World War One, and then, of course, in 1948, Israel displaced, drove out the Palestinians, basically, and the State of Israel was created.
Yes. In my show this afternoon, I made reference to the Arab Revolt, which took place...
That's right.
Between 1936 and 39, which
That's right.
coincidentally, I'm sure quite by coincidence, happened to coincide with the Spanish Civil War. So with that going on, I don't know that there was a whole lot of American attention on the Spanish Civil War, but with that going on, that would be all the more reason for Americans to ignore the Arab Revolt.
That's right.
I came across this awful piece of propaganda which calls itself the... No, I can't find the first page. It's a booklet, a 40-page softback booklet. I can't get to the first page. This is awful. On the cover it says... Israeli-Arab conflict, primer to understanding the centuries-old struggle. And then they had this...
Phyllis Bennett, I think, right?
It was what?
Phyllis Bennett's book.
Oh, is it? I haven't found her name. It says...
I think so.
It's for more information, go to IsraelJerusalem1948.com. My nephew picked this up at a gas station where he just came in to get gas. And close to San Jose here about a month ago, and he said these were stacked up very high on each of the gas pumps. So he grabbed one of them and brought it to my attention. And, yeah, I've gone through, I've argued with a number of the basic points, and I didn't get very far because I really get to be motor-mouthing when it comes to the situation right. between Arabs and Israelis. And I even apologized for that shortly before he called, saying, people, I don't want to demonize Israel. That's not supposed to be the focus of this this program. But it's very easy for me to get into doing that. You know, quite frankly, this being free radio, which is to say pirate radio, underground radio, we have a notoriously extremely low listener base. And getting you or anyone else to talk even for a few minutes on the show, I feel kind of guilty doing that because there may not be a lot of people who are listening to the show right now, but I do I do archive this show on a service called radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.NET. And I also put it up on the Santa Cruz Indie Base site as a weekly event, and I include a podcast. But I have most of the shows that I've been doing since I started this show last July on the Radio for All archive. So anyone who cares to look those up will hear this show as it is being recorded, and you are indeed being recorded for posterity here, Jeff.
All right, very good.
The show is on for another 3 minutes. Do you want to take up any or all of that time with anything more?
Right. Well, yeah, I think, this conflict, the Israel-Palestine conflict, is really something that affects Americans. It isn't just some faraway conflict somewhere in the world. You know, I think it really compromises American interests. I don't think Americans are aware of that. You know, it's isolating the United States, as you see in all the UN votes, when it votes to support Israel against the rest of the world. It compromises American human rights when it supports the occupation. And I think, the occupation is seen not only as an Israeli occupation, but as an American-Israeli occupation.
Uh-huh.
And I think for Americans that are concerned about their place in the world, you're fighting five or six wars in the Middle East. You have your security concerns. Yeah, there was a bombing today in Boston.
Yes, I
with
heard
all
that.
Of that, I think it's very important for Americans to begin to say, what's wrong? Why are we being bombed? Why are we being attacked? Why does the world seem to vote against us and resent us? And, of course, one of the answers is that the American presence in the world is all military, and Americans end up supporting occupations like Israel's occupation. So it's really going against the grain of where the entire rest of the world is going, which is more towards human rights, equality, inclusion. So I think this conflict is really something that should give Americans pause. And if they can reassess their approach to the Middle East, they can begin to reassess their whole position in the world.
It would contribute to that. And I do see our relationship with Israel, indeed, the very practices of the Israeli state, as a linchpin that if examined and picked at properly, can unravel a lot of the hostility that the world seems to have towards the United States.
Exactly. The United States has to decide whether it's going to join the world or bully the world. And if it wants to join the world, ending the Israeli occupation and its support is a good place to start.
Dr. Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Executive Director, is that right?
That's right.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Okay.
I treasure any opportunity to see you and to speak with you since we met back in 2008.
Right.
I love you, man.
It was very good to see you in Santa Cruz, and thanks for having me on.
And thank you again. I hope to see you again soon. Perhaps it'll be me who flies across the pond next time we see each other.
You're all welcome.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Be well. Bye.
Bye-bye. Dr. Jeff Halper, folks. Well, it's been a long time since we heard a voice other than my own. on this show. And in fact, the show has come to a close. It is 4:55, 16:55 hours Pacific Daylight Time. Mideast Madness will come at you again 1 week from today, 3 p.m. PDT on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're streaming live at freakradio.org. Don't forget to click on the red oval. We also broadcast locally here in Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM. This is Ren Tawil. Don't forget to send your emails to MideastMadness@gmx.com. Palestine Today is next. Thank you, everyone.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, April 15, 2013. Israeli soldiers clash with youth in the southern West Bank, and settlers attack a village in the northern West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli settlers attacked on Monday the village of Madama near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. According to villagers, a group of armed settlers from the nearby illegal settlement of Yetzar attacked villagers' homes and destroyed the water reservoir that supplies the entire village with drinking water. Later on Monday, clashes erupted between invading Israeli troops and local youth at Ahadar village near Bethlehem in the southern part of the West Bank. Local sources reported that Israeli soldiers used tear gas and sound bombs to attack residents and youth. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In other news, a report written by Israeli journalist Gideon Levy and published by Haaretz Hebrew Language Daily accuses the Israeli military of deliberately executing two Palestinians recently. The two were shot by the army at the Ennab roadblock east of Anabta near the northern West Bank city of Tulkarm.